Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As always, my name is Matthew Blittner. To my left, co-host Daniel Green. And in case you didn't catch our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com, this is Outside the Studio. So, for the next 59 minutes, please sit back, relax, and enjoy some hot and cold sports tapes. And Dan, boy, do we have a show for you here today. We're going to get started. Before we get to our two guests, we're going to get started with the first place New York Mets, who have a certain pitcher who has been lights out this year.
Yeah, I mean, Jacob DeGrom, I think every show right now should start off with Jacob DeGrom. I know that, again, he's had a lot of issues where he's not pitching as long, where he's not staying in as many innings, but his season is unparalleled. We've talked about the numbers before. The 0.5 ERA is unheard of. But here are some more crazy numbers for you. Hitters have a 113 batting average against him. That's only 1 point better than MLB pitchers have as a whole. They have a 112 batting average.
How about the fact that he's driven in more runs than runs he's allowed? That's Pedro Martinez circa 1999-2000 ridiculous. And that's better than what Pedro did that year.
You're starting to see stats with him that you haven't seen since like the dead ball era. It's unbelievable. He's had one run or zero runs allowed in 12 straight starts. Unheard of.
That breaks Bob Gibson's record from his 68 season.
So he's had an unbelievable season. I think if the season ended today, he would be obviously the unanimous Cy Young, like not even a thought about another vote, and would be probably the MVP, especially on this Mets team that's a good team, but really has not been scoring a whole lot.
I mean, how can you expect them to score when they've got so many injuries this year? And I know some of the players are starting to come back, which of course is very helpful for the Mets, but they've been without a number of guys throughout. They have, what, 10 pitchers on the IL? They've had issues. Conforto's had issues. Nimmo's on the 10-day IL. McNeil was out. Alonso was out. The list goes on and on.
But now you've got that moment of truth, right? It's because they are dead last in runs scored this year. And even though they've had unbelievable pitching from Walker, from DeGrom, from a lot of these guys, you haven't seen the scoring that this team needs to really take off. And that's partly, yes, because a lot of guys are out. But Conforto's back. He's on his contract year. Can he become a big factor? Can guys start to step up? Can Dominic Smith start to return to what he was doing earlier in the season? McNeil's back. It becomes really interesting to see what is this team capable of, because, yes, they've had an unbelievable year pitching, and nothing can be taken away from that. But you're not going to continue to be a winner in the league if you're dead last in offense.
I mean, it begs the question, not how good are the Mets, because the jury's still out, because we haven't really seen them healthy, fully healthy, for an extended period of time. The question is, how bad is the NL East? Not to make excuses or anything, but if the Mets are dead last in runs scored, yes, they've had terrific, terrific pitching led by DeGrom. No question, can't take that away from them, not even attempting to take that away from them. But in today's day and age, and yes, I know strikeouts are up, runs are down, hits are down, but if you're dead last in offense and you have the largest first place lead in the entire major leagues, that tells me that the rest of your division, not that good.
It's weird. The whole division is underperformed. By the way, including the Mets, they've also in a certain way underperformed, even though they're in first place. This weekend, they have a big series against the Phillies. Now, the Phillies are not the second place team. I think they're fourth.
They're third, I believe, but that could be semantics. It could be a percentage point or two out of four, above fourth.
But either way, like this is a big series, because all these series within the division become so big, and the Mets have to continue to win these games. But Philly was supposed to be better. The Braves should be better. The Nats are like starting to turn things around, but they should be better. It's not been a good division.
I mean, the Nats, they've been without Strasburg for a long stretch of time. Max Scherzer has proven that he's human with some of his injuries this year. The Mets have a huge doubleheader against the Phillies starting today. Actually, that first game should be kicking off probably about any minute or so right now. We all know that, you know, team and network say 4 o'clock or 4 or 5 started. Give it another 7 to 10 minutes before it actually starts. But they really do have an opportunity right now with this weekend series to potentially bury the Phillies and make this sort of a two-team race.
And again, once you get in the playoffs, especially as division winner, you're in a good spot. You're in a good spot to make a run. And if the Mets can build on this lead, it's not known what could they do, especially once they start to get healthy, whether they start to make a move. They can be a real force in the NL.
Making a move is going to be very important. The trade deadline is July 30th, not July 31st this year. Major League Baseball decided it wanted to move it up a day so that players weren't being traded and moving during the weekend so that they could already be playing during the weekend. I know, sounds ridiculous. But who do you think the Mets are going to be in the market for at this point? They clearly need another bat. Or two.
It's such a weird
situation. And they clearly need another pitcher or two, with 10 being on the IL.
Okay, it depends on what you think they should do versus what they are going to do. So they're in a weird situation where they have a lot of bats that they seem committed to, guys who were hurt, guys who have underperformed, but they still want to invest with their future in. So those are guys like Conforto, who was hurt and has underperformed, Dominic Smith. So I think it makes a lot of sense for them to get another bat. As we've said, they're dead last in runs. I think somebody like Adam Frazier from the Pirates would be an interesting move. It's a little bit of out of the ballpark. I think Eduardo Escobar, these aren't people that are necessarily being talked about. What is being talked about for the Mets is making a move because, yes, their pitching has been unbelievable, but can it stay unbelievable with the injuries that are piling up and with the fact that you're not going to get Syndergaard back? And you're not going to get those kind of guys back.
Well, the Syndergaard thing is definitely going to hurt. And that's going to create a very interesting thing in the offseason, no doubt. I think that Steve Cohen absolutely makes, you know, orders a move to his front office saying, listen, I'm giving you the cash. Go out and make the move. And they might make several. They could very well get two bats and, let's say, two pitchers, one starter, one reliever, because Lucchese is gone for the year, and probably all of next year, too, with the torn UCL.
But that's the thing, right? So he's gone, so that's why I could see them adding a pitcher, and they could go in a number of directions with that, because that's more of a middle-of-the-road guy. You're not necessarily, like, Lucchese's not a star. You're not necessarily,
I mean, he was putting together quite a run.
I mean, he was having a good year, but he's not, like, I think the priority should be a bat. It's just like,
multiple
bats. That's what your team is lacking. Now,
yeah, you can't expect Jacob DeGrom to continue to hit over 400.
This year, you have to see. Like, I think these next couple weeks become the proving grounds, right? Because you've got the deadline in the month. So if by the All-Star game you're still having these kind of issues with hitting, that's when you probably start to make a move.
Well, I guess we will see. Again, that Met game is kicking off right around now. So keep us on in the background, put the Mets on mute, and you can listen to what we're going to be talking about. Right now, I'm going to go get our first guest, whose name is Leah Hetzdahl, and she is a trailblazer for female play-by-play broadcasters in the National Hockey League. So I'm going to go get her, and Daniel is going to vamp as Daniel vamps.
I am ecstatic that we are going to get to vamp a little bit about Leah. She's an unbelievable person. What she has been able to accomplish, obviously, she was the first woman to cover the NCAA men's hockey championship. She's a vital part of hockey coverage. She's been, obviously, making massive strides for herself. And a lot of women have been making massive strides in broadcasting, but Leah is so interesting and also is such a great hockey mind and has so much to offer and so much to say. And what better time for it when our Islanders are playing a game 7 tonight?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back and we're joined by Leah Hetzdahl. Leah, it's Matt and Dan with Outside the Studio. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, gentlemen. How are you guys? I could listen to you guys talk all day because I love your accent.
Thank you so much. You know, we're clearly here from New York City. And, you know, for a lot of people who are wondering, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about, you know, where you're from, considering that you've become this trailblazer here. You know, you don't see too many female play-by-play broadcasters in the hockey world, in the men's hockey world at the very least. So, you know, talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I am sitting right now, gentlemen, in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and I am Manitoba born and raised. I've had the opportunity, though, to live in a few other incredible cities, including Boston when I worked my days at Nesson, and also Toronto with Hockey Night in Canada. But really, my lineage in the game starts with, and you guys will appreciate this being New Yorkers, with my grandfather, Brian Hextall, who was a New York Ranger and is in the Hall of Fame with the Rangers. He scored, actually, the OT winner against the Toronto Maple Leafs in 1940 for the Cup.
Oh, the 1940 Cup.
You got it, which was so, you know, had so much history behind it. And so Mark Messier came along with his guarantee and managed to get you guys another one. So, you know, but the fact is that's where it really started. And he was here in a little place called Poplar Point, Manitoba. From there, I had two uncles play in the NHL. My cousin Ron played in the NHL with the Philadelphia Flyers and is now the GM of the Pittsburgh Penguins. So I kind of just had hockey in the blood, as a lot of people say to me, but I never played the game myself. You know, when I was growing up, there wasn't actually women's hockey at all. You had to play with the boys, and I was a pretty slight child, and I wanted to try to play, but my dad said, as soon as they start hitting, you're going to have to quit, because women's hockey is not what it is today. And so I kind of just grew up playing street hockey and on the pond with games of shinny. But there was always a love for it, and I've had to learn the game over the years. And now, as you just said, Matthew, I have found my way into the play-by-play world, and some exciting things coming in the future, and a chance to, you know, be calling more games at the highest level of the game in the best league in the world, the National Hockey League.
And of course, thank you for educating our listeners on that, because a lot of people don't know that you're from such a hockey family and that you grew up with hockey in such a way. What do you think is key that made you want to get into broadcasting more so? Was it just that you had such a passion for hockey because you grew up around the game so much and it was your whole family's love?
Well, I think where it really started for me is, as a kid, you know, I was one of those weird kids that when we had an assignment in school where we had to do a speech, I got excited because I knew I'd get an A because I was a very good public speaker. And most people hate public speaking, but I always loved it. And on top of that, I was very involved in the dramatic arts. But then on the other side of my personality is I played every sport under the sun except for hockey, but I played athletics my entire life, and it's such a huge part of my life. So when I was looking for a career, my parents were very big in saying, do something you love, do something you would do for free. And I pretty much did just that, because when you first get into broadcasting, you don't make a lot of money. But I really married the two, my love for presenting and public speaking, and then my love for athletics, and I put it together and I went to broadcasting school. I did not know when I started out in my first job nearly 20 years ago that it would come to this stage in play-by-play. But what I would say is that this stage and this part of my career in play-by-play really came out of necessity, because for the majority of my career, I was a host in studio and a reporter, ringside reporter. And then I was laid off as part of the Hockey Night in Canada Sportsnet cuts in 2016, and I couldn't even get a job in the industry. And I pivoted outside of the industry into what I call a real job, and I've been holding down a completely different career outside of broadcast, but broadcast is my passion. And I decided, listen, I would like to pivot into something that perhaps there's no representation for women in doing. It was important to me to push for some progress. And I always wanted to see, hey, maybe I have the ability to call play-by-play. And I say that with great humility because it's so difficult. But that's really how the road started into the booth.
It really is absolutely difficult. And, you know, I've had the pleasure of getting to know a lot of the play-by-play broadcasters, both on the television side and the radio side, across the entire National Hockey League over the last few years. And, you know, it's one of the things that they always talk about, how it's probably the hardest sport to do play-by-play because the game is so fast. Everything happens so quickly. There's no reaction time. And there's a lot of different styles to it. You know, some people like to be more descriptive, where they give you every single second of what the puck is doing, where others like to generalize it a little bit more. So there's a lot to it. But for you, you know, you mentioned wanting to make that progress. What does it mean to you to be acknowledged as that trailblazer? Because, you know, someone has to be first, obviously. So if you're going to be blazing that trail for not just today's generation, but tomorrow's generation and the generation to follow, you know, they're going to be speaking about your name the way people have spoken about Foster Hewitt's name and Dan Kelly's name and Danny Gallivan's name. So what does that mean to you?
Well, it means everything, but at the same time, I look at that I'm still so in my infant stages of where I feel I can take this. You know, for me, it's not just about being a female play-by-play. It's about being the best play-by-play, because that's the nature of myself being a Hextall and my competitive nature. But when I hear the word trailblazer, of course, I'm completely honored by being attached to that. And I really immediately think of all the women who have come before me, and not just, you know, those women in sports broadcasting, but just women in general who have opened the doors for us to step into non-traditional roles, because that's really what I'm doing. There's never been anybody guarding a door saying, no, women can't do play-by-play. But I never grew up hearing a female's voice, not only in hockey, but in any sport, being the narrator to sporting events. I saw women at desks doing sports shows or ringside reporting or field reporting, but I didn't see play-by-play. And I think that's where this is the turning point, is that the more we can see it, and this is why representation matters, is because now when there's a full generation, as you mentioned, of young women and young boys who will hear my voice, and they're going to grow up thinking that's just the way it is. And that's really the goal, right, is to push for that. But in the first part of it is, you know, I'm really excited about when we get to the point where it's not, I'm not referenced as, you know, the first woman in the fact that someone's talking about me. I can't wait for the next woman to come along and do it, and then for me to be the reference point as Leah Hextall was the first. That's what I'm really looking forward to, is that progress.
And we all look forward to that. And I think it's so key that you're going to be able to push the narrative, so that the narrative is that a woman is calling hockey, and that whoever wants to call hockey can be capable of calling hockey. And that there is that progress. In terms of what have been your favorite games and moments that you've been able to cover, what would you say have been the best moments you've been able to cover?
Well, you know, I can't help but look back at when I made my NHL debut, and that was last March in 2020, literally 3 days before the world shut down because of the pandemic. So I'm very fortunate I managed to make my debut. But that game meant so much because, first of all, you're calling the game at its highest level, and it was an NHL debut. And, you know, you kind of have to reference it the way a player would feel. You know, you've worked so hard for this to get to this stage, and here it is. But I think what I'm most proud of in that moment, and why it's my favorite, is because there was such a spotlight cast on me because I was going to be the first woman to do it. And as many people that were supporting me, there was also people like, let's not get it twisted, that didn't want to see me succeed. And so the fact that I came into that as prepared as I could, did the work, earned the moment, and went in and I felt delivered on that stage with a big spotlight on me, I was really proud of that. And I was proud of, you know, Cathy Campbell-Pascal was in the booth beside me in the color role, and she is probably the greatest trailblazer I ever know, as the first woman to ever call color for Hockey Night in Canada, which is huge and prestigious. So I'm really proud of that. But, you know, it's amazing how moments start to collect, because just in March, I called the longest game in NCAA Division I men's history with the 5-overtime thriller between UMD and UND at the Fargo Regional. And now I look at that, and that's my most favorite moment, because I was able to stand in there for 6.5 hours and call.
That's
five
unbelievable.
And that really, guys, you know, for me, that game, what that did, and this is something that I said to a few people after, is, you know, prior to that game, because I was doing play by play so sporadically, because it's so hard to get reps consistently, I didn't ever say I was a play by play broadcaster. I said I was a sports broadcaster. But then I did that game, and there was something about that mentally that I thought, if I can stand in there for 6.5 hours, 8 periods of hockey, 5 overtime, and call that, and I'm one of a handful of people who have ever done it, now I can call myself a play-by-play. So that was a really big moment. So to me right now, that's my favorite moment, because it changed my confidence in the position of play-by-play.
And it's great to hear you talk so confidently about that. And, you know, I remember, you know, watching that game late and everything, honestly, I have such an appreciation for any broadcaster, male, female, whatever, to be able to stand in there and do a game that goes at length. I spoke to Gord Miller probably, I want to say, 2 weeks or so after the 5-overtime game between the Lightning and the Blue Jackets. And one of the things he said to me was, it's not something that you can prepare for. It's just something that, you know, when you're in the midst of it, you just got to do it. Because, I mean, you can't call in a sub. You can't be like, hey, we're going to go to somebody else. So it's really something that takes a lot out of people, but it's something that you'll never forget. And one thing to get us moving along a little bit that people are never going to forget is that the Montreal Canadiens last night just knocked off one of the Stanley Cup favorites, arguably, in the Vegas Golden Knights. And tonight, the Islanders and Lightning will face each other for the right to play Montreal. So I want to get your take on, one, who's going to win tonight, and two, who should win that inevitable Stanley Cup matchup?
Wow, loaded questions. You know, when it comes to Game 7 tonight, I always look at Game 7s as thinking it really doesn't matter on paper or who or what has gone on in the series, because it comes down to that single game, and that's what makes it so thrilling. But when I look at this, you know, it's such a hard one because I really do believe it's a coin toss, and that's not me opting out or not willing to get into the conversation, but it could honestly go either way. I have to say that when I look at the Islanders right now, they go out and they get absolutely annihilated and embarrassed with that 8-0 loss. And then they come back last night on the verge of elimination. They're down 1-0. The Tampa Bay Lightning kill off a 5-on-3, and then Cirelli goes and scores to put them up 2-0 over the Islanders at home. But those boys battled back and took it in overtime. And when I look at that, I don't believe that momentum swings from game to game. I believe it swings from shift to shift within a game. I don't believe momentum goes from game to game, but I do believe confidence goes from game to game. And there's something in me right now that believes that tonight is the Islanders' night. And, you know, I have to say, too, that might be a little bit of bias because there's two Manitobans on the team that I know very well, and Ryan Pulock and also the head coach, Barry Trotz. And I'm very close with the Pulock family. So I've been watching him since he was 16 with the Brandon Wheat Kings. And he had the same clapper then from the blue line that he does now. And, you know, so I have to say I'm kind of cheering for the Islanders a little bit. But I just feel like it's their time. But then, you know, hey, boys, like I could flip that over and say, these are the defending Stanley Cup champions. They are not going quietly into the night.
Well, they won't go quietly into the night. And who knows, we might be in for a long, long overtime game. And, you know, Kenny Albert, certainly, he's had a lot of experience doing games. So he might be calling you up tomorrow being like, how did you get through the 5-6 overtimes here? So the last part of this, if the Islanders do win, because, you know, we are a New York show, so we're gonna show a little bias right now.
Yeah, let's do it. Come on.
If it is Islanders versus the Canadiens, who are you taking to win that series?
Well, this is going to be, if it does turn out to be that, guys, it's going to be really interesting because they are two teams that play quite similarly. They're frustrating and they're smothering. And they're not the most flashy teams and they're not going to be making a lot of highlight reels. But, you know, at the end of the day, I always bet on Carey Price. I'm a big believer that if you have a goaltender, you have a chance. And there's no better goaltender on this universe than Carey Price, in my opinion. And I think that should, quite frankly, be everyone's opinion. And the way in which Montreal is playing right now, their defense is so strong. You know, their top pairing of Weber and Schrott are doing so well. And you add in Edmondson and Petrie, and they're amazing. And then, you know, you go to the fact that they have so much size on their defense, you know, 6'2 up. And then you go out front to their forwards. And, you know, is Corey Perry not built for playoffs? Absolutely. You look what Suzuki and Caulfield are done. These kids are playing like they don't have a care in the world because they don't. You know, they don't even know any better. They're just like, this is what's supposed to happen. We're just supposed to score goals and win Stanley Cups. This is the way the world works. And then, you know, you even have key pieces like Gallagher, who goes out there and fights so hard every night and is so underrated in what he does. And then Philip Deneau and his line's ability just to shut everyone down. You know, the Canadiens team, it is such an enigma to so many, but if you go back to the start of the season, they were a juggernaut at the beginning before they ran into their injuries, before they had a few issues with personnel, and, you know, they made the coaching change, which brought up the young kids. And I just feel that this is a team that feels that they are destined to win the Stanley Cup and are playing that way. And, you know, I would put my money on the Canadiens.
If it's not going to be our hometown Islanders, I would hope that it's going to be the Canadians. It's been too long since the Canadian team has won the Cup. It's been too many years.
Well, you know, don't get too upset because they are the most decorated team. They've won 23 Stanley Cups, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, so I don't feel too bad for them.
Well, there's no reason to feel bad. It would be a terrific series, and, you know, the passionate fans. The only thing missing from the potential Stanley Cup between that is that Montreal won't have a full Bell Center of rabid fans.
So we think right now. We don't know that for sure, right? That'll be interesting to see what happens here. Canada is getting very close, and they're all starting to open up. And when you see the melee outside of thousands of people that are allowed to gather outside, we'll wait and see what the Quebec government decides to do. You know, hockey rules there, so you might see a packed barn at the Bell Center before you know it.
Well, we can only hope and pray and hope for a great series, but more importantly, let's hope for an Ireland to win tonight. Leah, thank you so much for joining us. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we've been listening and talking with Leah Hextall, who, by the way, Leah is going to be getting a lot of opportunities in the near future to bring even more hockey games to you as a play-by-play broadcaster. So, Leah, we wish you the best of luck moving forward, and we hope to hear you one day doing a Stanley Cup game on your own.
Well, Matthew Daniel, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure, and enjoy Game 7 tonight.
Thank you very much. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Leah Hextall. So please make sure to always follow her career. That was terrific.
I liked the competitiveness because we've obviously, you know, the Hextall family, we know that lineage is so extensive, and you can even see it in the way that she talks about the game and the way that she's thinking about it and the way that she's treating announcing as if it's like she's in on the sport as well. And I really respect that. And I think all the great announcers look at it that way. They look at it as if they're competing to be better than the next announcer, that they're competing to be better than who they were yesterday. And she definitely has that kind of mindset. So it's great to have her on. Great to speak with her.
Absolutely it was. Now, before we get into our next topic, because we do have a lot to still get through here today, Dan, I believe our sponsor wants a word. So why don't you give them that word?
Y'all have heard me talk about them on the show before. Joco, it is a e-bike rental program around the city. It's the most sustainable, convenient, and enjoyable way to commute. They're electrically pedal-assisted bikes. They've got 35 private locations, and they're soon expanding to 100 across Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens. This space has grown so much over the past year. It's easy to see why. These bikes are faster, they're easier on hills, and it's far more fun than a traditional bike. The Joco bikes specifically, they're sleek, they're trendy, they're a smooth ride, they're great for sustainability, they're easy to use. All you need to do, you just got to download the app. Just go to Joco, the app, in either iOS or Google Play, and find a participating Joco bike location. The promo codes for our show, because, you know, you listen through us, you want to support our show and support our great sponsor, Joco. Click OTS15 for a free 15-minute ride and press OTS-MEM for $10 off your membership.
That's great, Dan. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, please make sure to use those promo codes as we really want to really drive home the synergy that we have with this electric assist bike share program, because it's a healthy and some might even say sporty way to get around town. And we're nothing if about sports at this show on Outside the Studio. So please go out and ride a Joco bike today. Dan, now that we've heard from our sponsor, we talked about the Mets at the top of the show. So I think it's only fair that after we gave your team a little spotlight, we give my team a little spotlight.
Do you want the spotlight, Matt? Do you want it? Do you want it?
I mean, we are 27-time World Series champions.
But do you want the spotlight right now specifically? This has been... Okay, I'm also somebody who picked the Yankees to win this year, and...
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't put money on that one.
It's not looking good. It's not looking good. It's their offense is really not measured up. They have a lot of guys that are really disappointing.
Disappointing? Gleyber Torres has a sub-700 OPS. This is the guy who had almost 40 home runs in 2019.
He's somebody who, because I've been watching a couple of these games lately. he's somebody who, look, he's still so young, right? He's 24, right? And
he's not as young as you may think. In baseball, they age in dog years.
Eh, that's fair, but he's still, I mean, 24 is very young. And he's only 2 years removed from having an unbelievable season. And last year was obviously tough for everybody, but he really has had really been a different kind of player. And a lot of people are saying there's issues with his swing. A lot of people are saying he's not recovered from last year and losing that kind of a rhythm. So that's very scary for the Yankees, who really, they need him to be the player that he was.
They need him to be the player that he was. The fans need him to be the player that he was. I need him to be the player that he was. And he needs himself to be the player that he was. So he's got a lot of riding on this. One player, however, who has done a complete 180, who was in Torres' seat not too long ago, is Gary Sanchez. Gary Sanchez burst onto the scene in 2015. Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. 20 home runs in the second half of the season. It was incredible what he was doing. Followed that up with, I think it was a 33 home run year in 2017. You know, then injuries started to set in. Look, you know, injuries happen to catchers. It's part of the job. The offensive numbers start to decline. Last year, he lost his starting job down the stretch to Kyle Higashioka. This year, he was horrible in April. He was benched in May. And now that June's coming to an end, you would think that on that trajectory, he would be designated for assignment. No. He bounced back in a big way. He might be very well the player of the month for the American League in June.
I think that's not a crazy argument to make. He's really had a great June. And with him, what you wonder about is, did that benching sort of kick him in the right direction?
He was benched last year and it didn't kick him in any direction.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this one was different. Maybe there was something about it where he took it seriously. It's hard to know, but that turnaround has really been incredible.
Well, he's always had excellent hands as a hitter. And in order to, that's the mark of a true good hitter, regardless of whether you're a power hitter or a hit for average or anything. Having good hands is key. But what you've been able to notice from Sanchez lately is the fact that he's really using and incorporating his lower body, similar to how he did in 2016. He's driving the ball a lot better. He's still a dead pull hitter, which is going to have its problems, especially for righties at Yankee Stadium, because it is known as Death Valley, left center field, for a reason. And he's using that lower body to really drive the ball, hit the ball a lot harder. Look, he's not going to hit the ball the way Stanton and Judge do at 115 to 120 miles an hour. But he's really lining up the ball. He's squaring up the ball. And that's helping. Really, I can't believe that the Yankees could not figure this out for the last 2 years, that it took until now. Whoever figured it out, send him on an all-expenses-paid vacation to Europe or wherever he wants after the season, because it's been nothing short of a miraculous turnaround for Sanchez. The guy's hitting close to 340 in his last almost 30 games at this point. He's got 7 home runs, 8 home runs in his last little over a dozen games. It's incredible what he's doing.
It's so interesting that you talk about the lower body situation, because that is what some analysts are saying is the issue with Gleyber Torres, is that he's actually letting his like hips leak out a little bit, and that he's, because he's not using his lower body as well, his swing is not quite doing as much as it needs to do. And it's telling that Sanchez was able to figure it out. So maybe there's hope for Torres as well. Maybe they can talk to whoever figured it out for maybe they could talk to the same guy and just figure it out together.
I mean, the only concern that I have with saying that it's a lower body issue for Torres, it's different. If you watch Torres, and Michael Kay pointed this out on the broadcast the other day, Torres has been lifting his front leg exceptionally high. There's leg kicks. There's leg kicks. And then there's what Gleyber Torres has been doing. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to be the only fix and the only thing that needs to happen to get him back on track. But you cannot time the ball properly when your foot may as well be even, when your front foot may as well be even with your inner thigh of your back leg. That just doesn't work. From a balance perspective alone, that doesn't work. So I don't know what it is. I don't know why he started doing that. He's lifting his lead harder than the Rockettes do when they're doing their show.
Love the Rockettes reference. And also with baseball, we always talk about baseball as such a sport of habit. It's such a sport where you just start doing something and then you get hooked in. And it snowballs. And I think that's the kind of thing. Bad habits build up over time, and you really need somebody to go in there and curb it and be proactive.
Well, speaking of bad habits, what's wrong with Aroldis Chapman? The guy has been... he has struggled immensely. I know one of the outings, he had a broken fingernail on his hand, which, of course, will affect your ability to pitch properly. I'm not gonna blame that one on him. But there's been something wrong with him for the last six, seven outings. What's happening?
He's been awful. And they were lucky to win the game the other day, or yesterday, I think it was, right? Where he blew the save.
It was Wednesday.
He blew the save. And, again, I don't necessarily agree with the decision that Boone has made in that.
We are very anti-Aaron Boone decisions on this show.
You know, I was less so, and then I watched more of the games, and I was like,
So you came around to your senses.
I came around to my senses. That was a bad decision, but again, that outburst and then giving it up, like blowing the save, that's not excusable. And yeah, he's had a tough thing. Now, relievers do get streaky, but not him, traditionally. He's somebody who's been a rock, so... Yeah, this is somewhat of a cause for concern.
It might lead the Yankees. Look, they already need to get another pitcher or two for the starting rotation. Who knows when Luis Severino is going to be back now that he has a groin strain on top of the return from Tommy John surgery. So they definitely need to get at least a pitcher or two for the starting rotation. They might need to look at getting a couple of relievers, and not to say that Chapman loses the closer role, and even if he did, they have Zach Britton over there waiting in the wings. But it's something that's going to really affect them, and if the Yanks are going to pull out of this hole that they dug themselves in, they're going to have lights-out bullpen pitching, and at the moment, that's not the case. I will tell you who is lights-out, though, and that's Luke Voit, who just came back, and he seems to be throwing yard, or almost throwing yard, every night.
It's good to see him back. You saw that he had the walk-off single the other day, and you see that impact that having him back makes. Again, I don't want to... Matt always likes to go pessimistic on the Yankees.
Hey,
I think that's
been a Yankee fan since 1993, okay? I have a right to be pessimistic about this team.
I understand that, but I do think that this is a serious hole, and they do have real structural issues that they need to think about, because this is their year. Like, this should theoretically be a year that they are going off, and it's not happening, and they're in a competitive, very different type of division than the Mets. The Mets are last in runs. The Yankees are, by the way, 21st in runs, and again, you have less room for error when you're in the AL East than when you're in what has been a disappointing NL East.
Well... that AL East is going to be one horrible hill to climb out of. And if the Yankees should miss the playoffs, which is a very real possibility at this moment, you will hear me on this show routinely calling for Aaron Boone and Brian Cashman's heads. But that's enough of the negativity. There's something that we need to get into, and we have our second guest about to join us. And his name is John Shannon. For those of you who don't know, John is one of the preeminent NHL insiders. You want to talk about knowing things, equate him to Adam Schechter, equate him to John Heyman, equate him to whoever you want. The guy is as plugged in hockey as anybody. I'm going to go get him while Daniel once again vamps.
This is a pretty special guest to get for our show. He's one of the top NHL insiders, as Matt was saying. And he's somebody who, if you want to know where the news is, you want to know what the big story is, he's somebody who is consistently breaking that. He's somebody who has obviously good knowledge of what has happened this year and what will happen as we go into the off season as well. So it's great to have him on the show, and I'm looking forward to speaking to him now.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back here with John Shannon. John, it's Matt and Dan with Outside the Studio. How are you today?
I'm doing great, boys. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us here ahead of, you know, we're just a few hours out from Islanders Lightning Game 7 down in Tampa. So I've got to ask you, John, this is a series that a lot of people thought the Lightning would win in 5 or 6 games. You know, maybe a few New York bias people thought that the Islanders could have a chance here. But after the Islanders lost Game 5, 8-0, I don't know that too many people gave them a chance. And now here we are. So what's your take on what's going to go down in probably about 3 or 4 hours from now?
Well, I tell you what, I think it's a lot more even than most think. You know, the Kucherov question is one thing, but I would never discount a Barry Trotz coached team in a Game 7. If the Islanders can control the tempo and use some of their big bodies, as they have been allowed to do in this series, particularly from guys like Mayfield, Pelech, Pulock, and the rest of that blue line, if they're able to do that, then I think it's a 50-50 situation between the Lightning and the Islanders.
What do you see happening with Kucherov? Because obviously he had that injury early in Game 6. What do you see about his role in Game 7?
Well, I mean, I don't think we know. I don't even, I mean, if John Cooper's telling you that it's a game-time decision, if I think he's got his fingers and toes crossed that that he can go. If it's a core issue that Kucherov has, then whatever he can contribute to this team is a bonus. We know this team can win without him, but can they win and take the physical grind that the Islanders give this team without him? That'll be the key. You know, Game 7s are such a wild card. Semyon Varlamov and Andrei Vasilevskiy are the two keys for both teams. I would not be surprised to see a very low-scoring 7th game, 1-0 or 2-1, as the team advances to play Montreal.
And, you know, you mentioned playing, you know, going on to play against Montreal. Before we get to that, though, the Islanders, you know, they've been built now by this 2-time Jim Gregory GM of the Year Award winner in Lou Lamoriello, the only GM to take the award back-to-back years. You know, what are your thoughts? You've obviously gotten to know and see Lamoriello over probably his entire career. So what are your thoughts on how he manages to just year in and year out get the most out of his teams?
Well, I have the utmost respect for Lou. I am lucky enough to know him well. And what I would say is that Lou creates accountability, structure, and loyalty. And in many ways, what's interesting, Matt, what's fascinating is that before he hired Barry Trotz, they really didn't know each other. They didn't know each other very much at all. And yet I would tell you, those are the exact same traits that Barry Trotz wants out of his players. And so this was a marriage that Lou created by getting Barry Trotz behind the bench. And I think that's one of the reasons why it succeeded so quickly on Long Island for the Islanders with Lou and Barry there. The players know that this management team, this coaching staff has their back. They know that there is accountability expected, and they deliver in spades. Hey, by the way, we better give Garth Snow a little bit of credit. There are a lot of players on this roster from the Garth Snow regime, and if this team does go on to the final and does go on to win the Stanley Cup, Garth Snow has to have a little bit of a wry smile that he put a lot of those names on that Stanley Cup as the general manager of the Islanders.
Absolutely, and you know, it's something that Islander fans probably don't like to admit, what with how sour that relationship between the fans and Snow got towards the end. Of course, not his doing, you know, there was a lot of external factors going on there. But you just said something very interesting about the dynamic between Lamoriello and Trotz. And I'm wondering, do you see that same type of, you know, they didn't really know each other, but, you know, it worked out really well, dynamic in the works now for Ron Francis in Seattle, now that he got Dave Hextall as his coach? Because a lot of people thought that this was going to be Rick Tocchet's job, and it almost seemed like Hextall was a little out of the blue.
Well, the one thing I can tell you, again, another guy I think I know pretty well, is there isn't any more thorough person in the game of hockey than Ron Francis. He's a thinker. He has thought a great deal about what has gone on for every hire he's had in his organization. And I think the process that he went through with Dave Hextall is one that goes from nights of discussing hockey philosophy when they were together for Team Canada at the World Hockey Championships in 2019. I think that Ron is a resource himself. And I think what Ron saw in Dave Hextall was somebody who was organized, who creates accountability, and creates a great deal of structure, which I think Ron appreciates. And so if there's an upside, he did go and create an extension of himself. If there's a downside in that, the question will become is, do you have enough different style of voices in your organization to succeed? And that goes back to what Barry and Lou have. I think Barry's strong-willed enough in his own right to be able to talk to Lou man-to-man, and I think Lou would appreciate that.
That level of accountability and that level of being able to reach out to your players is so key for an NHL coach. One coach who was hired here, who it was a very interesting choice, not at all shocking, for the New York Rangers was Gerard Gallant. What are your thoughts on him being part of the Rangers and this whole front office shakeup that occurred with the Rangers this past offseason?
Well, you know, Chris Drury obviously has a plan that that Jim Dolan will give him an opportunity to execute, which is what it's really about. It will be interesting to see how that occurs over the next little while. The one thing we do know, like the Islanders, Drury has inherited a pretty good young roster of players that can play the game. Gerard Gallant, is a very good coach. Gerard Gallant, I think, doesn't get enough credit for being as much of a tactician as he is a motivator, but I think there is a little bit of tactics in Gerard's life that he understands. What he does do is he keeps it simple. And, you know, he's not going to sit there and tell Artemi Panarin how to stick handle or try to tell one of their young guys how to improve his skills. But he will be able to instill a system. He will be able to make sure they work well away from the puck.
But
he will create an environment, guys. He will create an environment that is fun to be in. And at this level, I think that's really important.
But in terms of the Rangers, they're a very young team. They have a lot of guys who have massive potential, some of who have done incredible, like Fox, and some of who are still developing, like Kako and Lafreniere. Do you think that style will translate and push some of those younger players to really max out and reach their full potential?
Well, let's look at this guy's resume. He's done this before. He went to the Memorial Cup twice with a junior team. He knows how to talk to young people. I think that's one of the forgotten traits that this guy has. He can work with young players. He worked with 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds. I think he can work with the 21-year-old pro. I think that was one of his secret sauces with the St. John Sea Dogs or the QMJHL. And I think that we're going to see that with the Rangers.
He's had that, you know, ability to bond with his players, which, of course, as you're mentioning, is key. It's maybe a little bit concerning to some fans that he's gotten let go in the third year of each of his stops. But, you know, it's a clean slate here in New York, so hopefully that will not happen this time. And so there's a player who needs a clean slate in the National Hockey League, and it gets so much attention, and that's Jack Eichel up in Buffalo. Do you see Eichel, one, do you see him getting traded? And two, if so, who is most likely to take on that contract? And what are they going to have to give up for this young star who happens to be dealing with a pretty bad injury?
Well, I'll tell you what, if I'm a team, guys, if I'm a team, I want to make sure that I'm buying 100% of Jack Eichel. And I think that that's the biggest concern right now. I mean, let's face it, the relationship between Eichel and the Sabres went sour when the discrepancy of understanding what the injury is, how the injury should be treated, whether there should be surgery or not was created. You know, that's going to be, to me, a major issue for any team that's going to contemplate getting Jack Eichel. Do I think at 100% he's a good player? Absolutely. He could be a great player. He could be a superstar. But if I'm the Buffalo Sabres, you know, I have to make sure that in protecting my asset as a trade, that I'm getting enough for Jack Eichel. The marriage seems to have broken up. But at the same time, if I'm the general manager of the Buffalo Sabres, I'm not giving away Jack Eichel for anything. And if I'm the team looking for Jack Eichel, like a Columbus, or even the Rangers or the Boston Bruins, I'm not sure in a flat cap era I can take all of his salary off. And I have to think about that as well. I have to think about, okay, how much are the Sabres prepared to pay, at least for the next 3 years, while we live in the $81.5 million cap era?
So do you see this move as happening? Because it seems like a broken marriage, and it seems like both sides are disgruntled to a degree, but the way you make it sound is the obstacles may be insurmountable. So do you see this move as still happening, or is it too much with everything?
Well, I don't think it's that simple of it's going to happen or not going to happen. Do I think both sides are going to try to explore it, that it does happen? Absolutely. But I would not say it's a guarantee. And I don't think Kevin Adams can have on his resume. I don't think he can have on his resume. He gave Jack Eichel away. And if I'm Jack Eichel, I'm not sure that I want to be put in a position that I go somewhere that I'm not 100% healthy either. So I think there are enough variables and enough questions now, and between let's say the first day of free agency, the 28th of July, I'm not sure that we're going to have those answers in that period of time.
John, it's obviously something that's going to develop over time and has been brewing for quite a while. But if there is one answer that we can get right now, and it's not something about any players, because we've gotten a lot of information about them today, we want to get an answer about you. There are a lot of people who are listening to this show right now who are wondering how they can become the next John Shannon, how they can be that NHL insider. And obviously, it's something that doesn't happen overnight. It's something that will take a lot longer than it will take for the Buffalo Sabres to make a decision on Jack Eichel. So if you could give us a brief thing, what would you say to those aspiring NHL insiders? Because let's be honest, there's only a few of you guys, and that's for good reason.
Well, this has been a long process. It's a work in progress, guys, and it's 45 years in the making. I got lucky enough to get involved in the NHL as a teenager. I worked 2 days a week at Hockey Night in Canada in the mid-70s. I got to travel as a teenager. I was at the right place at the right time in 1979 when the four WHA teams came in. And then, quite frankly, I spent 35 years behind the camera and not on the air, creating relationships and building those relationships, and really only got to do this in my mid-50s. So it was 35 years of apprenticeship to become an insider when I was 54 years old. And, you know, you have to be patient. You have to work hard. You have to be able to walk up and talk to people. You have to be able to sacrifice your family time, your holiday time. And you have to love the game and have a as I told somebody else recently, you have to have the fire in your belly to be at the rink every day.
Oh.
And if you could do that, then there's a chance.
Thank you very much for that. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we've been talking with noted NHL insider John Shannon. John, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And we look forward to continuing to follow your, you know, all your news that you bring to hockey fans everywhere as the NHL offseason begins in earnest after the Stanley Cup.
Well, it's great to hear. Just to, I'll give my own plug. I work with one of the great broadcasters in Canadian radio. His name is Bob McCowan. It's the Bob McCowan podcast featuring John Shannon. We do it every day. Every day. It's up on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and there's lots of hockey in it, and there's lots of good discussion on it. And so if you like the business and you like our sport, then it's an easy listen. It's never more than 48 minutes. We're never as long as Merrick and Friedman, who they like to have War and Peace every week. So,
Thank you for that. And, John, we highly suggest everyone go listen to it, and we thank you so much for your time here today.
Have a good weekend, boys, and let's go Islanders.
Yep, let's go Islanders. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are at that time where we are going to move into our fan caller, and his name is Topher, so we're going to get Topher in right now to give us his sports take. So let's get him on the line.
Right.
Hey, Topher, it's Matt and Dan with Outside the Studio. How are you today?
Doing well. How you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us. So what's this sports take of yours?
Yes, it's an honor to be on the call again. So there's an epidemic, a hidden epidemic in the NBA that I think people are overlooking this playoffs. And the epidemic's name is Kendall Jenner. First, she came for Blake Griffin, took out the old man's knees. He could barely even dunk. And then she came for Ben Simmons. And we saw what happened over the last week. The man can't shoot. He has no confidence. He's a joke of an offensive player now. And I think we got to be wary of her because apparently she's with D-Book right now. And that man's on his way to NBA championship. He may win it this year.
I don't know. I like the conspiracy.
Gone to him yet, but like by next year, D-Book is going to fall off a cliff. I guarantee it.
Ben Simmons never had a great shot. It's like one of the parts of his game that he really needs to work on. But I do get what you're saying. Blake did fall off. And it is fun to blame Kendall Jenner, but ultimately, Ben Simmons needs to spend a lot of time working in the offseason because that was embarrassing.
Topher, I am going to give you our first ever nickname for a fan caller, and that's going to be Conspiracy Theorist. Okay, that's your title from now on when you call in.
I'm with it.
You're our Conspiracy Theorist, okay?
But it does make sense that... Look, Booker's had an unbelievable season, and hopefully this curse doesn't continue. Hopefully it's not the next curse of the Billy Goat or something like that, because he's been such a pleasure to watch, and Ben Simmons did fall off, and that was a rough series. That was a rough fourth quarter.
That was horrible.
Yeah. Well, he's never been able to shoot, obviously, but at least he cut and was aggressive, and now he's just a shell of a human being.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Topher. And we look forward to your next conspiracy theory in the very near future.
Aliens are real. Talk to you soon.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, that was our now conspiracy theorist. I didn't think I'd ever be claiming someone was going to be that for us on the show, but, you know, things happen. Unfortunately, though, that's all the time we have for you today. So if you missed our live show, you can cast your coins on thenyextra.com. Spotify, Podomatic, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Player FM, iTunes and Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. So please tune back in next Friday, July 2nd at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for more Hot and Cold Takes. Once again, I'm Matthew Blittner. To my left is co-host Daniel Green, saying thank you for tuning in. And if you enjoyed our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, please visit her website, JD Compositions, for her full work. And we'll see you next time on the one and only Outside the Studio.